behind a crate when the light from his lantern shone upon it.
"It will be a while before they start nibbling on this stuff."
He turned his light on the sallow-faced llamas as they carefully set down the crates and started to leave the hold.
"Tell your friends to get that poison ready on the quick. If we do not smoke out these vermin, your tapestries will be gnawed so badly we will have to sell them as thread."
The warning put a certain haste in the llama's step as they withdrew from the hold. Mortrim started to follow them as the men made their way back onto the deck. He had only taken a few steps when he noticed that Drumark was still standing down near the tapestries.
"Are you coming?" Mortrim asked.
"In a bit,"
Drumark answered, waving him away. Mortrim shook his head and left the hold. Alone in the rat-infested hold, Drumark glowered at the shadows. The stink of vermin surrounded him, making his skin crawl. Instead of withdrawing from the stench, he let his revulsion swell, feeding into the hate that boiled deep inside him. Rats. Pestiferous, murderous fiends. Whatever size they came in, they had to be stamped out wherever they were found. He would happily do his part. He owed that much to his father, burned down by the foul magics of the loathsome Skaven. Drumark looked at the crates, and then back at the noisy shadows. Despite his talk with Mortrim and the llamas, he was anything but certain the rats would spare the tapestries. The vermin were perverse creatures and might gnaw on the precious hangings out of sheer spite. Well, if they did, they would find a very irritable Dwardin waiting for them. Checking one last time to be certain Mortrim was gone, Drumark walked over to a dark corner near the door and retrieved the object he had secreted there without Brokrin's knowledge. He patted the heavy stock of his deck sweeper.
"Some work for you before too long," he told it.
Returning to his original position, he doused the lantern. Instantly, the hold was plunged into darkness. Drumark could hear the creaking of the guide ropes as the ship swayed on its mooring, the groan of the engines that powered the ironclad's huge endrin, the scratch of little claws as they came creeping across the planks. Gradually, his eyes adjusted to the gloom, and Drumark could see little shapes scurrying around the hold. Soon the shapes became more distinct as his eyes became accustomed to the dark. Rats, as fat and evil as he had ever seen. There must be a dozen of them, all scurrying about, crawling over barrels, peeping into boxes, even gnawing at the planks. He kept his eyes on the crates with the tapestries, all laid out in a nice little row. The moment one of the rats started to nibble at them, he would start shooting. But the rats did not nibble the crates. Indeed, Drumark began to appreciate that the animals were conspicuously avoiding them. At first, he thought it was simply because they were new, a change in their environment that the vermin would have to become comfortable with first. Then, one of the rats did stray towards the row, fleeing the ire of one of its larger kin. The wayward rodent paused in mid-retreat, rearing up and sniffing at the crates. Drumark could not know what the rat smelled, but he did know whatever it was had given the rodent a fright. It went scampering off, squeaking like a thing possessed. The rest of the vermin were soon following it, scrambling to their bolt holes and scurrying away to other parts of the ship. Soon, Drumark could not hear their scratching claws any more. Keeping his deck sweeper at the ready, Drumark sat down beside the door. He stayed silent as he watched the crated tapestries, his body as rigid as that of a statue. In the darkness, he waited. The wait was not a long one. A flutter of motion spread through the rolled tapestry at the end of the row. Faint at first, it increased in its agitation, becoming a wild thrashing after a few moments, the cloth slapping against the bamboo that enclosed it. Someone, or something, was inside the rolled tapestry and trying to work its way out. Eyes riveted on the movement, Drumark rose and walked forwards. He aimed his deck sweeper at the tapestry. Whatever had hidden itself inside, it would find a warm reception when it emerged. The thrashing persisted, growing more wild, but making no headway against the framework that surrounded the tapestry. Whatever was inside was unable to free itself, or unwilling. A horrible suspicion gripped Drumark. There were four more tapestries, and while his attention was focused on this one, he was unable to watch the others. Drumark swung around just as a dark shape came leaping at him from the shadows. The deck sweeper bellowed as he fired into his attacker. Drumark saw a furry body go spinning across the hold, slamming into the wall with a bone-crunching impact. He had only a vague impression of the thing he had shot. He got a better look at the creature that came lunging at him from one of the other crates. Thin hands with clawed fingers scrabbled at Drumark as the creature leapt on him. Its filthy nails raked at his face, pulling hair from his beard. A rat-like face with hideous red eyes glared at him before snapping at his throat with chisel-like fangs. He could feel a long tail slapping at his legs, trying to hit his knees and knock him to the floor. Drumark brought the hot barrel of his deck sweeper cracking up into the monster's jaw, breaking its teeth. The creature whimpered and tried to wrest free from his grip, but he caught hold of its arm and gave it a brutal twist, popping it out of joint. The crippled creature twisted away, plunging back down on top of the crates. Any sense of victory Drumark might have felt vanished when he raised his eyes from the enormous rat he had overcome. Six more of its kind had crawled out from their hiding places in the tapestries, and unlike the one he had already fought, these each had knives in their paw-like hands. They stood upright on their hind legs, chittering malignantly as they started towards the lone Dwardin.
"Skaven!"
The cry came from the doorway behind Drumark. The discharge of his deck sweeper had brought Horgar and several others of the crew rushing into the hold, concerned that the sergeant had finally lost all restraint with the rats infesting the ship. Instead, they found a far more infernal pestilence aboard. The arrival of the other Dwardin dulled the confidence that shone in the eyes of the Skaven infiltrators. The mocking squeaks took on an uncertain quality. Ready to pounce en masse on Drumark a moment before, now the creatures hesitated.
"What are you waiting for, lads?" Drumark shouted to Horgar and the others. "The bigger the rat, the more of our beer it will drink. Get the scum!"
The sergeant's shouts overcame the surprise that held the other Dwardin. Armed with shovels and axes, Horgar led the crew charging across the hold. Their backs against the wall, the Skaven had no choice but to make a fight of it. As he rearmed his deck sweeper and made ready to return to the fray, a terrible thought occurred to Drumark. The tapestries and their devious passengers had come from the Lamasery, a place from which Captain Brokrin had not yet returned.
"Hold them here," Drumark told Horgar. "I have to alert the rest of the ship and see if we can help the captain."
The young initiate held the ornate door open for Cho and the Dwardin as they entered the shrine where Pyutulku had been entombed after his ascension. The room was smaller than the grand reception hall, but even more opulently appointed. The hangings that covered its walls were adorned with glittering jewels. The pillars that supported its roof were carved from blackest ebony and highlighted with designs painted in gold. The varnished floor creaked with a musical cadence as the visitors crossed it, sending lyrical echoes wafting up into the vaulted heights of its arched ceiling. Ensconced upon a great dais, flanked by hangings that depicted the wingless dragon and the fiery phoenix, the living god of Kaitar reposed. Pew was still a fat man, but his flesh had lost its rich colour, fading to a parchment-like hue. He wore black robes with a sash of vivid blue, the same raiment that had been given to the mummies Brokrin had seen in the Lamasery's vaults. Yet Pew was not content to remain in motionless silence. Just as the Dwardin had decided that the Lamas were delusional and that their late leader was simply dead, the body seated atop the dais opened its eyes and spoke.
"Enter and welcome,"
the thing on the dais said. The voice was dull and dry, with a strange reverberation running through it.
"Dwardin friends, always ever welcome in Kaitar."
It moved its head, fixing its empty gaze in Cho's general direction.
"Have you given help aid to our guests?"
"Yes, Holy Tulku," Cho said, bowing before the dais. "The tapestries have been sent to their ship, as you commanded."
The thing swung its head back around, facing towards the Dwardin. It extended its hands in a supplicating gesture. The effect was marred by the jerky way in which the arms moved. Brokrin could hear a faint, unnatural sound as Pew moved its head and hands, something between a pop and a whir. He had seen such artificial motion before, heard similar mechanical sounds. The Tulku was similar to an etheric musician he'd seen in the great manner of Grand Admiral Thorgrad, a wondrous machine crafted in the semblance of a Dwadin bard. The only blight on the incredible automaton's music had been the sound of the pumps inside it, sending fuel through its pipes and hoses. Whatever the esoteric beliefs of Kaitar, what sat upon the dais was not an ascended holy man. It was only a machine. Pew began to speak again.
"It is to be hope prayed that we shall all profit gain from."
Brokrin stepped past Cho and glared at the thing on the dais.
"I do not know who you are, but I will not waste words with a puppet."
The outburst brought a gasp of horror from the initiate at the door. Cho raced forwards, prostrating himself before the dais and pleading with Pew to forgive him for such insult. Brokrin gave the offended lamas small notice. His attention was fixed to the hangings behind Pew's dais. There was a ripple of motion from behind one of them. Pushing aside the snake-like dragon, a loathsome figure stalked into view. He was taller than the Dwadin, but more leanly built, his wiry body covered in grey fur peppered with black. A rough sort of metal hauberk clung to his chest, while a strange helm of copper encased most of his rodent-like head. Only the fanged muzzle and the angry red eyes were left uncovered. A crazed array of pouches and tools swung from belts and bandoliers, but across one shoulder the humanoid rat wore a brilliant blue sash, the same as that which adorned Pew.
"Now you may speak, Meg,"
the ratman growled as he stood beside Pew. His hairless tail lashed about in malicious amusement as he smelled the shock rising off the Dwadin.
"Mighty Kilvold Tuku," Cho cried out. "Forgive me, I did not know they were such barbarians."
Kilvolt waved aside the High Lama's apology. He fixed his gruesome attention on Brokrin.
"No defiance, beard thing,"
he snarled, pointing a claw at either side of the room. From behind the hangings, a pack of armored skaven crept into view, each carrying a vicious halberd in his claws.
"Listen here, I no learn about your pot nest. Your clankin make build ships that fly climb higher than any others. I won't demand that secret."
"Even if I knew it," Brokrin snapped at Kilvolt, "I would not give it to you."
The skaven bared his fangs, his tail lashing angrily from side to side.
"Then I take tear what I want need. Already you let bring my warriors into your ship."
He waved his paw at Cho.
"The tapestries this full meat gave you."
He gestured again with his paws, waving at the skaven guards that now surrounded the Dwadin.
"If they fail fall, then I have hostages to buy the secret of your ship. Torture or ransom will give bring what I—"
Kilvolt's fur suddenly stood on end, a sour odour rising from his glands. His eyes were fixed on the pistols hanging from the belts Brokrin and Gotram wore. He swung around on Cho, wrenching a monstrous gun of his own from one of the bandoliers.
"I order say, take fetch all weapons."
The skaven punctuated his words by pulling the trigger and exploding Cho's head in a burst of blood and bone. The violent destruction of the lama spurred the Dwadin into action. With the skaven distracted by the murder on the dais, Brokrin and Gotram drew their pistols. Before the ratmen could react, the Arcanaut captain burned one down with a shot to its chest, the etheric charge searing a hole through its armour. Brokrin turned towards Kilvolt, but the skaven took one glance at the multi-barreled volley pistol and darted behind the seated Pew Tulku. Instead, Brokrin swung around and discharged his weapon into the skaven guards to his right. The volley dropped two of the rushing ratmen and sent another pair squeaking back to the doorways hidden behind the hangings, their fur dripping with blood. Gotram was firing again, but the skaven were more wary of their foes now, ducking around the pillars and trying to use them as cover while they advanced.
"We are done for,"
Skaggy groaned, keeping close to the other Dwadin. Alone among them, the logisticator really had come into the room unarmed.
"We have to negotiate,"
he pleaded with Brokrin.
"The only things I have to say to Skaven come out of here,"
Brokrin told Skaggy, aiming his volley pistol at the guards trying to circle around him. The ratmen were unaware the weapon had no charge, and seeing it aimed in their direction had them falling over themselves to gain cover. A crackle from the dais presaged the grisly impact that sent an electric shock rushing through Brokrin. The armor on his back had been struck by a blast from Kilvolt himself. Feeling secure that the Dwadin were distracted by his hench rats, he had returned to the attack. The oversized rings that adorned one of his paws pulsated with a sickly green glow, a light that throbbed down to them via a series of hoses that wrapped around his arm before dipping down to a canister on his belt. The heavy armor Brokerin wore guarded him against the worst of the synthetic lightning. He turned his volley pistol towards the dais. Kilvolt flinched, ducking back behind the phony Tulku. As he did, the Ratman's eyes fixated on something behind the Dwadin captain.
"The boy thing!" Kilvolt snarled from behind Pew. "Stop kill, boy thing, you fool meat!"
Brokerin risked a glance towards the door. It had been flung open, and the initiate was racing into the hall outside, screaming at the top of his lungs. Immediately, half a dozen of the Skaven were charging after him, determined to stop him from alerting the other llamas about what was happening in Pew's shrine. The ratmen made it as far as the door before a Dwadin fusillade smashed into them. Skaven bodies were flung back into the shrine, battered and bloodied by a concentrated salvo of gunfire. Just behind them came their executioners, Drumark leading his Grunstock Thunderers. The surviving guards squeaked in fright at the unexpected appearance of so many Dwadin and the vicious dispatch of their comrades. The creatures turned and fled, scurrying back into their holes behind the wall hangings. A few shots from the Thunderers encouraged them to keep running.
"The leader is up there!"
Brokerin told his crew, waving his pistol at the dais.
"There are tunnels behind the tapestries! Keep him from reaching them!"
Even as Brokerin gave the command, Kilvolt came darting out from behind the dais. His retreat would have ended in disaster, but the Skaven had one last trick to play. To cover his flight, he had sent a final pawn into the fray. Pyutulku rose from its seat and came lurching towards the Dwadin. There was no doubting the mechanical nature of the thing now. Every jerky motion of its limbs was accompanied by a buzzing whir and the sour smell of leaking lubricants. Its hands were curled into claws as it stumbled towards Brokerin, but the face of Pew still wore the same expression of contemplative serenity.
"Right! That is far enough!"
Drumark cried out, levelling his deck sweeper at the automaton. When the Pew thing continued its mindless approach, he emptied every barrel into it. The shot ripped through the thing's shell of flesh and cloth. In crafting his Tulku, Kilvolt had stitched the flayed skin of Pew over a metal armature. The armature was now exposed by Drumark's blast, as well as the nest of hoses and wires that swirled through its body. Despite the damage inflicted on it, the automaton staggered onwards. Drumark glared at it in silent fury, as though it were a personal affront that it remained on its feet. While the sergeant fumed, Brokerin took command.
"Thunderers!" he called out. "Aim for its spine! Concentrate your shots there!"
The Thunderers obeyed Brokerin's order, fixing their aim at the core of the Pew thing. Shots echoed through the shrine as round after round struck the automaton. Under the vicious barrage, the thing was cut in half, its torso severed and sent crashing to the floor. The legs stumbled on for several steps before slopping over onto their side and kicking futilely at the floor.
"And stay down!"
Drumark bellowed, spitting on the fallen automaton. Gotram seized hold of the sergeant's arm.
"We have to get back to the ship! There are more of them in the hold with those tapestries!"
"Already sorted out," Drumark declared. "By now, Horgar should be done tossing their carcasses overboard. I figured you might be having trouble over here, so me and the lads grabbed one of the llamas and found out where you were."
Brokerin felt a surge of relief sweep through him. The Iron Dragon was safe, at least for now. He turned his eyes to the dragon tapestry and the tunnel Kilvolt had escaped into. Even now, the Skaven were probably regrouping to make another attack.
"Everybody, back to the ship," Brokerin said. "The sooner we are away from here, the better."
He gave Skaggy an almost sympathetic look.
"When we get back, we will have to dump the tapestries over the side as well. We can't take the chance the Skaven put some kind of poison or pestilence on them."
Skaggy clenched his fist and rushed to the wall. With a savage tug, he brought one of the hangings crashing down to the floor.
"If we have to throw out the others, then we had better grab some replacements on our way out."
Catching his intention, Gotram and some of the Thunderers helped Skaggy pull down the other tapestries. The hangings were quickly gathered up and slung across the shoulders of the Dwadin.
"What about the rat poison, Captain?"
Drumark asked, as they hurried through halls that were empty of either llamas or skaven.
"We cannot trust that either," Brokrin told him. "We must do without it."
He gave the sergeant a grim smile.
"I hope you remember where you put your spade."
Drumark sighed and shook his head.
"I remember. But overall, I would rather stay here and shoot Skaven than play whack-a-rat with a shovel."
That was Ship Rats by C.L. Werner, read by John Banks. Auction of Blood by Josh Reynolds, read by John Banks. At the stroke of 7 on the arranged evening, Palin Bok found himself wandering the miasma-choked back alleys of Greywater Fastness. A bookseller and a spy, Bok was the epitome of neither. Tall and nondescript, he was all sharp angles and conservative colours. A grey man in a grey world. Despite the dull hues of his garments, however, they were of an expensive cut, tailored to his lean form. Bok was a man with standards, if nothing else. As the evening wore on, he traversed the tangled rookery with no sign of fear, despite the hostile eyes he felt watching him from darkened doorways and the cracks in boarded-over windows. Greywater Fastness was a hard city, and its people unforgiving of weakness. Bok was not weak. There was death in his heart, and there was nothing stronger than death. Even so, his pale gaze flickered warily from side to side, watching the shadows for some sign of the person he'd come to meet. His hand rested close to the edges of his frock coat and the slim multi-chambered flintlock pistol holstered beneath his arm. The pistol was of Dwadin manufacture, and thus guaranteed to perform its function without incident. Much like Bok, it was a most dependable weapon. He smiled as the thought occurred to him. There were worse things to be than a weapon, and worse masters by far than the one who wielded him, or rather, mistress. It had its annoyances. For instance, his intent for the evening had been to meet with a certain contact. He wished to arrange the purchase of a rare Dwadin bead book, purloined at no small expense from the libraries of the rune master of the Hermdar Lodge. There were any number of his usual clients who would dearly love to own such a rare volume on the art of fire-steel blending. Instead, he was now wandering this crooked labyrinth of back alleys, waiting for his mistress's servant to reveal themselves. Laughter echoed from a side street, where a crowd tossed rotting food into a massive cage. Inside it, a serpentine cockatrice shrieked and slammed against the bars. Its avian skull was hooded in order to protect Gorkas from its deadly gaze. The hulking beast's owner kept up a steady patter, trying to attract punters to come and see it up close. He felt a thrill of revulsion at the sight. He felt no sympathy for the creature. It was a foul thing, corrupt and twisted by sour magics into an abomination. He just hoped the cage was sturdy. Loose metal rattled, somewhere out of sight. Bok paused, a finger breadth from drawing his pistol. Head cocked, he listened to the sounds of the city. Greywater Fastness was never silent. Its ironclad walls reverberated with the sounds of industry. The great furnaces roared day and night, and the sound of hammers ringing on metal filled the streets. A thick pall of soot and grime covered everything, blackening the walls of the buildings and obscuring the street. It was at its worst after a rain, and it was almost constantly raining. Overhead, glowing spores drifted as they always did after a downpour, making strange patterns in the sooty air. Where they touched something solid, they took root and sprouted into shimmering fronds of iridescent greenery. Bok hurried into a covered alleyway, brushing some from his coat before they had a chance to blossom. He heard muffled voices echoing strangely through the cramped street. In the dim light of a sputtering oil lantern hanging above a nearby doorway, he caught a glimpse of shambling figures, beggars seeking shelter, as he was. Night soil wagons creaked somewhere, close to hand. The bells on Cathedral Hill tolled the hour, and a flock of crows hurtled skywards from the slum rooftops, croaking raucously, their feathers gleaming with spores. Out of the smog lurched a beggar woman. She was small and hunched, wizened by hard living. She gazed at him through a veil of ratty hair, and her eyes lit up. She shuffled towards him across the filthy cobbles.
"Sir! Good sir! Arms, sir!"
she wheezed. He could see bone gleaming through the pallid fuzz. Patches of leper moss crawled across her skinny arms and marred her cheeks. Box's nose wrinkled at the stench of her.
"I have no arms, woman. No comets, no motes, no flinders for such as you."
He made a show of fumbling at his pockets. Despite his obvious disgust, she did not turn aside.
"Arms, sir. Arms for the poor."
"Leave me in peace, wretch. I said I have no money."
Bock took a step back as her stink enveloped him. His skin crawled at the thought of her touch. She caught the edge of his coat. Annoyed, he lowered a hand, and a thin blade slid from a concealed sheath into his waiting palm. One more body on the night soil carts would not be noticed.
"But you have red hands, brother, and they have performed black deeds,"
the woman mumbled through rotting teeth. Arthritic fingers contorted themselves in a sign known only to a few. Bock relaxed somewhat, sliding the blade back into its sheath before making a similar gesture. This, then, was the person he'd come to this squalid alley to meet.
"The valley low and the shadows long," he said, completing the code phrase. "Hail and well met, sister. You bring some message from Our Lady of Air and Darkness?"
He tried to keep the suspicion he felt out of his tone. It wasn't unknown for agents of the Queen of Mysteries to practice their arts upon one another in an attempt to rise in their mistress's esteem. Silent, swift wars occasionally broke out between rival agents and their followers. Bock had taken part in his share of these altercations, though never without good cause. For her part, his mistress seemed unconcerned, even amused by such internecine conflict.
I do, brother. Our queen is much impressed by your handling of that matter with the playwright some months ago. You rise swiftly in her regard, bookseller. Continue to do so, and there is no limit to what a man of your caliber might achieve."
"You may thank the great lady for me, but I'm content with my lot. The life of a humble dealer in rare volumes suits me, I find. But I will serve her to the best of my meagre abilities, even so." It was a practiced speech, at once self-effacing and boastful. The beggar woman grinned, as if in shared jest.
"Just so, bookseller. What profits it a man to forget his station, eh?"
She coughed phlegmily and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
"We all have our parts to play in the black game."
Growing impatient, Bock leaned forwards.
"Get to it. What does she want of me?"
"What she always wants, bookseller. You are to procure her something tonight."
"I have other business tonight."
The beggar woman hissed, rheumy eyes narrowed in almost queenly disdain. She pulled herself erect.
"You have no business save that which Our Lady allows you, bookseller. And you would do well to remember that. The charnel grounds are full of those who forgot that her desires superseded their own petty yearnings."
Bock smiled mirthlessly.
"I remember. What is it, then? Another rare grimoire? A treatise on the architectural styling of Lantean Empire? A book of poetry, perhaps? Or the journal of some forgotten explorer?"
"It is not a book at all, brother. It is something greater by far."
The beggar woman clutched at his coat. She leaned close, and he gagged at the smell of her.
"There is a certain house near the old Fen Gate, its shutters marked with the sign of the magpie."
"I know it."
Everyone knew it. Everyone who was anyone, at least. The magpie's nest had played host to illicit dealings of all sorts since the city's founding.
An auction is to be held there this very evening for a select few. You will go and procure for our lady that which she desires.
Am I to guess, then, what that might be? The beggar woman licked her chapped and blistered lips.
You will know when you see it, bookseller. It is quite unlike anything else.
She fingered the buttons of his coat.
Do not fail her, brother. Now, give me an arm, sir. Give me an arm, lest someone mistake us for acquaintances.
She glanced around furtively.
Hurry, brother.
Grudgingly, he fumbled a coin from his coat and pressed it into her filthy hand.
Here. Now be off with you, wretch!
He shoved her, for good measure. She scrambled away into the murk, with a shriek, he thought, not a little overdone. He'd often heard it said that there was a frustrated thespian in every spy. Bock sighed. An auction. He hated auctions, though he attended them often. At least this one was in the city, and close to hand. But he'd had no time to prepare. Then that was likely the point. Neferata, Lady of Sorrow, was as cunning as she was powerful. The Queen of Mysteries gave her servants little warning of tasks they might resent, so as to ensure they did not waste time attempting to avoid them. Few tried to do so twice, in any event. He turned his feet towards the old Fengate. It seemed he would have to procure the bead book another time. Such was the price one paid to serve the Mortark of Blood. It was said by some that to serve Neferata was to serve death, and there was no master greater than death. Bock had lived in death's shadow since his childhood. He had hunted rats in the alleys of Hammerhall, one more feral orphan among the teeming multitudes. His parents had been soldiers of the Free Guild, he thought, though he did not remember them with any true clarity. It had been another life, and in another realm besides. From rats he had graduated to men. Even in the most orderly of cities, there were criminals. And criminals, or at least those of a certain station, often required the assistance of a man of Bock's skills. He could balance a ledger and slit a throat with equal ease. Since he was a boy, he'd had a gift for sums and words, as well as blades. He had taught himself to read and write in his leaky lean-to among the rubbish and vermin. Now, he lived in a modest room above his little shop at the end of a cul-de-sac. Even in a city like Greywater Fastness, there were those who appreciated books, especially old books with cracked bindings and yellowing pages, which enterprising booksellers could charge handsomely for. He still wasn't certain how he had come to Neferata's attentions, or why she had chosen to take him into her service. He suspected that it had something to do with his previous life. He had sent many souls shrieking to the lands of the dead. It was not inconceivable that Neferata had heard of him from one of his victims, and saw in him some potential. She had many pawns, some human, some not. Ageless and deathless, Neferata regarded the mortal realms as a game board, and men like Bock were her pawns. All he knew for sure was that he owed much of who he now was to her patronage. She paid well, better than his old criminal masters, and often. And all she asked in return were regular missives, reporting on the activities of certain individuals native to the city, or the acquisition of rare texts and items of minor interest. Sometimes those acquisitions turned bloody, it was true, but such was a bookseller's lot, and Palin Bock was a very good bookseller. Though there were days when he considered hiring an assistant, someone to run errands or commit the odd murder. Upon leaving the tangled alleys of the rookery, he caught a rattle-trap. The steel-rimmed carriage was an uncomfortable-looking vehicle pulled by a steam-powered automaton, wrought crudely in the shape of a horse. As he clambered into the battered conveyance, he held up a coin to the driver.
"There's an extra comet in it for you, if you get me to the old Fengate before the next tolling of the bells."
The driver, a retired Free Guild soldier by his look, saluted lazily with a hook that replaced his left hand, and gave a gap-toothed grin. He wrenched on the levers that rose up around his bench, and an excess of steam flooded the artificial innards of the mechanical horse. It gave a creaking whinny and clattered forwards, the rattle-trap swaying in its wake. The streets of Greywater Fastness were narrow rivulets of stone and metal, lit by oil lanterns or lightning jars. The latter dangled from iron chains, their flickering radiance washing over buildings and making the shadows dance. The rattletrap passed through these striations of crackling light, carrying Bok to the city's southern edge. Stone gave way to baked mud and thatch. The streets became wider, broken up by brick canals and wooden bridges. Turgid waters flowed slowly through these slimy corridors, diverted from the freshwater marshes beyond the walls. Occasionally, marsh trogoths would haul themselves out of the canals, their flabby, scaly flesh encrusted with barnacles of ossified filth. The lumbering beasts would rampage through the slums, attacking anyone foolish enough not to seek shelter. They were almost always driven back by the soldiers of the Free Guild, and their bodies added to the great furnaces as fuel. The marshes were smaller now than they had been when Bok first came to the city, and the walls farther out. Every season the city grew, and the wilderness shrank. Industry was ever the shield of civilization, as an engineer of Bok's acquaintance put it. He gave little thought to such things himself, and rarely left the inner city if he could help it. Bok was a man of soot and solid streets. The wilds of Gairan held little to interest him.
"Here we are then, sir,"
the driver grunted. There was a harsh burr to his voice, marking him as an Azerite. Bok had no issue with Azerites, though he knew those who did. What realm a man was born in mattered less to Bok than whether he had coin to spend. Bok paid him and climbed awkwardly to the street. The old Fengate rose tall and solid over one of the largest and oldest of the canals. It had been the first gate when the city was new and the marshes wild. The walls of the city had bypassed the towering structure, leaving it to become the de facto centre of a neighbourhood. There were shops now, instead of barracks, and the sides of the canal were thick with clustered clapboard buildings. The magpie's nest was one of those that crouched on the edge of the water. It bent over at an unsightly angle, faded bird shapes daubed on its broken shutters. It looked as if one tremor would send all three stories sliding full into the canal. But looks could be deceiving. The building was sturdier than most, its foundations deep, and its walls cleverly designed to fool the eyes of the uninvited. He felt eyes on him as he made his way to the rear entrance, as was the tradition. The front door was for the Free Guild, or agents of the city's rulers. The door overlooking the canal was for those who'd come to conduct business. Entrance was normally by invitation only, though occasionally there were open auctions, for the less notable. He had attended one of these open auctions before, but had left empty-handed. His resources, while substantial, were not infinite, and the bidding had been fierce. Then, given that it had been a rare copy of Kelaf's band symphony, The Mirror of Onyx, perhaps not surprising. He wasn't sure what was required of one to receive an invitation. He hoped it wouldn't be an issue. He knocked on the door, once, and politely. It was always best to be polite, in these circumstances. It cut down on bloodshed. He heard the heavy rattle of a bar being withdrawn, and a moment later the door swung inwards. A slim figure was waiting for him. An elf, he realized, taking in fine-boned features too perfect to belong to a human. Eyes like chips of obsidian met his own. She, and it was a she, though it was often hard to tell, was clad in loose robes of violet and a hauberk of black jagged mail. A thick mane of white hair was swept back from her narrow face by a tiara of dark iron, and she had a curved falchion sheathed at her waist. The elf looked him up and down, an unpleasant smile crawling across her pale features.
"Invitation?"
she purred, her fingers rubbing slowly against the pommel of her blade. "I don't have one, I'm afraid."
"That is a shame, but the canal is close, and it will be quick."
Her fingers tightened about the hilt, and she made to draw her blade. Bok stepped back, ready to produce the blade hidden in his sleeve, though he disliked his chances. He'd fought elves before. The experience had been unpleasant. "Surely that I am here speaks to my character."
"Not favourably," she said,
taking a quick step towards him. Bok hesitated. Instinct said flee. But she hadn't drawn her blade yet. Maybe she was curious. Or bored. It must be dull guarding a door. "I've come for the auction."
No invitation, no auction.
She spoke serenely. How much to garner an invitation, then?
That depends entirely on who you represent, my friend.
The voice was a man's. The elf turned, bowed, and stepped back, though her eyes never left Bok. The newcomer took her place at the door. He was a small man, fussy-looking, but bedraggled, like a scribe gone ever so slightly to seed. True to that image, he held an armful of scrolls, and his hands and the cuffs of his robes were stained with ink.
Well?
He pressed, adjusting the battered pince-nez he wore.
On whose behalf do you darken our doorway, sir?
A lady of some substance.
There are many ladies in Greywater Fastness. A Shale here, for instance.
The little man gestured to the elf.
I require a name.
The way he said it made Bok pause. It was as if the little man were trying to impart something.
There we must part ways, sir. Her name is not mine to reveal.
The little man shrugged and glanced at the elf. She smiled and reached again for her blade. Bok, thinking quickly, said,
Shadows and dust, sir.
Attempting the code phrase was a gamble, but he had little to lose. The little man looked at him. He adjusted his pince-nez.
Just and unjust alike,
he said, after a moment.
You are one of hers, then?
I have that honour.
Bok relaxed slightly. He had guessed right. Neferata's influence stretched wide through the low places. All those who served her, even in the most minor capacity, recognized the code phrases of her agents. It was obvious to him now that she would have someone in the house to alert her to the presence of certain items.
That is a word for it, certainly.
Very well. Shale, he may enter. The elf frowned, but made no attempt to argue. She ignored Bok as he stepped past her and entered the house. The entryway was a small, rounded chamber. A single corridor, out of sight of the door, extended deeper into the house.
The auction is soon to begin. Come this way. Master...
Bok. Palam Bok. Bok followed the little man down the hall. Doorways lined its length, each draped with a thick black curtain. Each curtain had sigils of warding and other less recognizable magical symbols woven into its folds. There would be illicit dealings going on in each of the rooms. Thieves laying plans, murderers plotting. The magpie's nest was a house of rogues. The little man glanced at him.
The bookseller.
You know me?
Of you. I am Pell. You are welcome here, sir. I trust you have come better prepared than your last visit. You were quite upset to lose that Kelaf symphony, I recall.
I am here on another's behalf this time.
In truth, Bok had no idea how much Neferata expected him to pay for whatever it was she desired, or whether she was even planning to compensate him. Such were the perils of a whimsical mistress. Perhaps she expected him to simply steal whatever it was.
Yes, I presumed so.
Last time I was here, you had someone friendlier on guard duty.
Shale has her talents. Friendliness is not one of them.
Pell smiled. She serves well enough to keep things civil among our patrons. Bok grunted noncommittally. Pell stopped before one of the doorways.
You will notice that you have not been disarmed. We expect all patrons to show a certain level of decorum in repayment for our hospitality.
I remember.
Good. Through here, please.
Pell twitched the curtain aside, and Bok duly entered. The room beyond was not large. It was illuminated by half a dozen lanterns, scattered about and hanging from iron stanchions. The room itself was a plain square of wood and stone, barren, save for several rows of hard benches, and a flat stage set at one end. On the stage was a long table, and upon it were various objects of interest, a loose pile of thin volumes, obviously a set of some sort, a gruesome, bull-shaped icon that bore all the hallmarks of Dwardin craftsmanship, a bell jar containing a night-blooming flower with amethyst petals, a small casket with brass hinges and a bear stamped on the lock, and a gilded skull with silver teeth. But the most interesting of the lot was a curious whip-like weapon consisting of 8 jagged metal bars, joined together by thin rings, so as to form a chain of sorts. It had a handle made from a carved femur at one end and a barbed dart at the other. The chain was coiled loosely and rested in a circle of what appeared to be dust or salt. Protective sigils had been chalked into the surface of the table around it, and the air above them shimmered with an oily quality. Something about the weapon unsettled him. There was a malign potency to it. It reminded him of a bog viper readying itself to strike. And even as the thought occurred to him, he knew that it was what he had been sent here to acquire. Neferata wanted it, whatever it was, and that meant he had little choice but to acquire it. Bok took a seat, ignoring the glares of the other attendees. The benches were crowded. He surreptitiously studied the competition. Many of them were like him, intermediaries acting on behalf of those too fearful or too well known to attend the auction in person. Others were more interesting. One, sitting towards the front, was clearly a representative of the collegiate arcane, to judge by his ornate robes of white and gold, and the supercilious expression on his overfed features. He murmured softly to a small, dragon-like homunculus perched on his shoulder. Another of the attendees was shrouded in all-concealing robes and a hood, with a strange segmented mask hiding their face. The facets of the mask were marked with what might have been Dwardin runes, though not ones Bok recognized. The runes glowed dimly, and faint contrails of what might have been smoke or steam rose from them. A woman dressed in crimson-dyed furs and leathers sat towards the back, her scarified features twisted in a frown. Her head had been shaved, save for a single braid bound with brass wire. A savage from the wilds of Gur, perhaps, given the ritualistic nature of her scarring. She caught his glance and smiled widely, as if in invitation. Her teeth were filed. Bok looked hurriedly away. Any further study of the crowd was interrupted by the arrival of the auctioneer. A thin man, fox-lean and ginger-haired. Pell was with him and took a seat near the stage. The scribe opened a heavy ledger on his lap and produced a writing quill from somewhere about his person. He dabbed it into a cup of ink hanging from around his neck and began to write. The auctioneer took his place on stage, hands clasped behind his back.
"Greetings, gentles all. Welcome, and be at ease. My name is Ranaldson, and I will be master of these ceremonies. Our first lot is the collected Revelations of Nekoho, or the Light of Doubt, a fundamental text for an obscure sect of anti-theists. Opening bid is 100 comets, or the equivalent." Once begun, the auction progressed swiftly. One by one, the items were secured by eager bidders, and the losers were left to grumble and scowl.
The stranger in the segmented mask claimed the grotesque, bull-shaped icon with a sizable bid of 2,000 comets. The gilded skull, revealed to be something called the Gelt Oracle, was decisively won by the Collegiate Arcanum representative, and a fat merchant from Hammerhall walked away with the amethyst blossom after a winning bid of 100 shards of shade glass. A pair of Dwardin almost came to blows over the casket, which proved to contain a single bottle of wine of ancient vintage. From the cut of their clothes and their harsh accents, Bok thought they might have been guilders, fresh from the Caradron skyports. Finally, the item he'd been waiting for came up for bid. Ranaldson seemed hesitant as he turned to the weapon.
"And our last item, a weapon of curious design. It has proven to be unique, as were the circumstances of its acquisition."
The auctioneer hurriedly looked away from the weapon.
"Through the diligent efforts of Master Pell and others of this house's staff, we have confirmed that this is, in fact, quite possibly Charu, the Soul Lash, one of the infamous 8 Lamentations."
A stunned murmur swept through the crowd. Bok stiffened. Neferata's desire for the weapon made sense now. He'd heard the stories. Everyone in his profession had. 8 weapons forged by the servants of the blood god Khorne in the age before the storm of chaos had washed over the mortal realms. The 8 lamentations had been scattered and lost, appearing occasionally to wreak havoc before vanishing once more. Rumour had it that they had begun to resurface of late, and Neferata had directed her agents to keep their eyes and ears open for any hint of the weapons. Bok had never thought to find one here, practically in his lap. From behind him, he heard the woman in red murmur,
"From fire came heat, from heat shape, and shape split into 8, and the 8 became as death."
Ranaldson gestured for quiet as the crowd's murmuring threatened to boil over.
Please, gentles, please, rest assured, we are certain of the item's provenance. All effort has been made to keep it contained safely, though I hasten to add that we are not responsible for anything that may occur once it leaves these premises.
He gave a brittle smile.
Opening bid is 3,000 comets, or the equivalent.
Bok grunted in consternation. A hefty sum, and one he couldn't go far beyond without emptying his coffers. It would be worth it, though, considering the rewards Neferata might bestow upon him for delivering such a prize to her. But before he could make a bid, the woman in red called out,
"There will be no bids. The item is not for sale."
She stood, and a hostile muttering swept the benches. At her gesture, several other members of the crowd stood as well. They all wore shades of red, Bok saw, though the garments of some were of a more expensive cut than others. Their faces were similarly scarred, some in less noticeable ways, but for all the barbarity of her appearance, it was clear the woman was in charge. She stepped into the aisle between the benches and strode towards the stage. Ranaldson cleared his throat.
"I beg your pardon, milady, but
I am Kesh, and I do not give it. This weapon is not yours to sell, little man. It belongs to a god, and we have come to take it back, in the name of he who strides the red skies, wolf-fanged and mighty."
She swept back her furs, revealing a brass-banded belt and a pair of crude hand-axes hanging from it. The others threw off their cloaks or tore open coats to reveal similar axes of varying craftsmanship.
"You will give it to us," Kesh continued, "or I will take your skull."
She unhooked an axe and pointed it at him.
"Khorne demands it, and you will not gainsay him."
Ranaldson spluttered. Bok had no doubt that the man had been threatened before, but perhaps never so bluntly. Others might have tried to win the bidding first, before threatening murder. But the servants of the blood god were not known for their subtlety. Pell chose that moment to lunge for a bell pull hanging beside the doorway, but a thrown axe dashed his brains across the wall. As the scribe crumpled, Bok drew his pistol and fired. One of the cultists was punched off his feet, a red hole between his bulging eyes. With the echoes of the shot hanging on the air, the room exploded into violence. He saw the stranger in the segmented mask snatch a blood cultist from his feet and hurl him across the room in a display of inhuman strength. A hurled axe sank deep into the bench behind Bok, narrowly missing him. He spun, but held his fire. Instead, he cracked the blood cultist across the skull, dropping her to the floor. The Dwardin pistol only had 5 shots. Bok was determined to waste none of them. People were shoving and screaming, trying to escape the room. The blood-mad killers hacked and hewed at the crowd with furious intensity. Some among the patrons resisted in their own fashion. The 2 Caradron had drawn their cutlasses and fought back to back, their earlier argument forgotten. The collegiate arcane representative spoke a word of power and turned a cultist into a living torch. The warrior screamed and fell across the benches, setting them alight. Somewhere, an alarm bell had begun to ring. In the confusion, Kesh had reached the stage. Bok tried to take aim at the woman, but a cultist rose up before him, chanting the 88 names of the blood god as he chopped wildly at the panicking crowd. Bok shot him, but the cultist didn't fall. His axe slashed down, nearly taking Bok's arm off. A second shot punched his head back and dropped him to the floor. Desperate now, Bok forced his way through the crowd, determined to prevent Kesh from claiming the weapon. As he reached the stage, he saw Ranelson leap to the floor with a panicked yell, clutching a bloody arm. He fled, screaming for help. Kesh laughed and reached for the chain whip, a dripping axe clutched in her other hand.
"I think not," Bok said.
Kesh turned, teeth bared, axe raised. He fired his pistol as the axe left her hand. She clapped a hand to her leg and shrieked. The axe pinned his coat sleeve to the table and knocked him off balance. The pistol clattered from his hand. He tore himself loose from the table as Kesh caught up her prize. There was a crack, like stone splitting, and her fingers wrapped about the bone haft of the weapon. The links of the chain clattered as if in welcome, and a shudder ran through it and her. Her eyes flashed with red lightning, and as she turned, he saw that every scar on her face had opened anew and was bleeding.
"The soul lash is mine, weakling," she snarled, whirling the chain whip about her.
Bok threw himself aside as the barbed tip snapped out with a silky hiss. It tore through the throat of an unfortunate man near the stage. There was a sound like tearing cloth, and a shimmer of greenish energy erupted from the dying man. It spun around the barb and was almost instantly drawn into the weapon. Kesh hissed in pleasure and leapt to the floor, whirling the chain whip up and about her in a growing frenzy. It tore through the crowd and her followers alike. More surges of light were torn away from falling bodies, green, red, ochre, blue, and drawn into the links of the weapon.
"Yes, it is as the Bloodseers claimed. Charu drinks the spirits of the fallen. I feel their strength within me."
She laughed wildly.
"Blood and skulls for my Lord Khorne!"
The room was rapidly filling with smoke. The lanterns had been knocked over in the chaos, spilling burning oil everywhere, and the sorcerous fire started by the wizard leapt from bench to bench. There was a scrum at the doorway as people tried to force their way out. Those left inside were either trying to stay out of Kesha's way or brawling with her followers. Kesha's form was limned with a sickly radiance. The chain whip moved like a thing alive rather than a weapon. Perhaps it was hungry after its captivity. Bok pushed the unsettling thought aside as he found his pistol and scooped it up. He tried to line up a shot while she was distracted, but too late. The chain whip bent about her of its own volition and darted towards him. The barb tore Flinders from the stage and forced him back a step. Kesh turned before he could recover, and the whip arrowed towards him again. He twisted aside, but not quickly enough. One of the metal bars caught him in the ribs and smashed him from the edge of the stage. Pain flared through him as he hit the floor, and he felt as if something in him had torn loose. But luckily, the barb had missed him, and his soul remained his own. He heard the crackle of magics and saw the collegiate arcane representative fling ethereal lightning towards Kesh. She snarled and cracked the whip. The spell tore in two, and ragged motes of light danced across the air. Unhindered, the barbed tip caught the wizard in the chest and tore his soul screaming from him. The backlash of sundered magics howled through the chamber, overturning benches and smashing bodies against walls. Bok lay still, eyes closed against the glare. When he opened them, the crowd was gone. Most had fled, but the rest had not managed to escape. And Kesh was nowhere in sight, though he could hear the clash of weapons somewhere out in the corridor. For a moment, he considered letting that be the end of it. He could slip out, with no one the wiser. But Neferata would know, and that thought was more frightening than any mystical soul-eater. Wearily, he hauled himself to his feet and stumbled out into the hall, after retrieving his pistol. Smoke filled the space. The fire had spread. The corridor was littered with bodies. Some had been trampled, others bore bloody wounds. The unseen alarm bells were still ringing, and he heard the thump of running feet somewhere above him. He staggered down the hall, clutching his side. Kesh had carved herself a path to the street. The marks of the chain whip were evident on the walls and floor, as well as on many of the bodies. When he reached the entry hall, he saw that the heavy door had been smashed off its hinges. There was no sign of the elf. From outside, he could hear the rattle of steel and the stamp of feet. He reached the door and stopped. Outside, the elf, Shale, and Kesh spun and fought with a speed that defied description. The elf moved with all the quicksilver grace of her kind, but Kesh matched her speed, driven to inhuman extremes by the power of the soul lash. Shale's blade deflected the chain whip as it curled around her, sending the barb spinning away. Kesh parried the elf's counterstroke with her remaining axe. The two women stamped and whirled back and forth along the edge of the canal. The ragged remnants of stolen souls clung to Kesh like a smoky shroud, and her laughter boomed out over the waters as she fought. Bok leaned against the doorframe, wheezing. His side ached where the chain had crunched against his ribs. Kesh's three surviving followers hadn't noticed him yet, enraptured as they were by the duel. He extended his pistol. One shot left. He would need to make it count. Time stretched unbearably. Smoke from the fire billowed past him, filling the street. Then it happened. Shale lunged, but Kesh smashed her blow aside, throwing her off balance. The barb of the chain whip hissed down, smashing her sword from her hand and throwing her to the ground. Kesh gave a shout and swung the soul lash up, ready to add the elf's soul to her collection. Bok fired. Kesh stiffened. The side of her head was a red ruin. She turned, wobbling on her feet, her remaining eye fixed on Bok as her warriors turned. Kesh took an unsteady step towards him. The soul lash snapped and twisted like an angry viper. Her mouth worked, but no words came out. She made as if to raise the chain whip, but instead pitched forwards with a disgruntled sigh and lay still. Bok swung his pistol towards the remaining cultists.
"Stay back, or I'll fire!"
The blood cultists snarled as one and started towards him, axes raised. He tossed the empty pistol into the face of the closest and drove a kick into the midsection of another. An axe bit the air, dangerously close to his head, and he turned, punching its wielder. The haft of a weapon caught him in the side of the face, and he staggered, the street spinning. A second blow knocked him from his feet. He covered his head and rolled away. He heard a scream and glanced up. Shale stood behind one of the cultists, her sword embedded in his back. She ripped it free and twisted, opening the jugular of a second. The third roared and leapt at her, axe raised. Bok snatched up a fallen axe and surged to his feet, catching the cultist in the abdomen. The man folded over with a gurgle, and Bok released the axe, letting the dying man slump. Shale looked at him, eyebrow raised.
"I had him," she said.
Bok shrugged.
"You're welcome to the credit."
She frowned and studied him.
"You fight well, for a human. I'm sorry we did not get to match blades earlier."
"I'm not," he said. She laughed.
"No, it would have been a shame to kill you."
Iron grated against the street. An ugly moan filled the air. Shale turned, and past her, Bok saw Kesh struggling to her feet. Blood and brain matter dripped down the side of her face as her good eye fixed on them. Bok stared.
"A bullet to the head usually does the trick."
Before Shale could reply, the barbed head of the soul lash rose up over Kesh's back like a scorpion stinger. The links clicked like laughter as the woman took a step towards them, and he realized suddenly that Kesh was no longer in charge. Whatever fell power lurked within the weapon, it had obviously decided that it wasn't finished with them yet. With an inhuman screech, Kesh jerked forwards, slashing at them with the chain whip. Bok lurched aside and felt the air part before his face as the chain slashed down. Shale attacked, driving her blade into Kesh's side. The woman ignored the blow and shoved the elf aside.
"She's already dead," Bok shouted.
"Then how do we kill her?"
the elf demanded, ducking beneath the arc of the chain whip. She scrambled backwards. Bok frowned, at a loss. Kesh laughed. There was nothing human in the sound. Broken spirits swirled about her, bound to the monstrous weapon. They moaned in what might have been pain, and the killing sigils hammered into the iron bars of the chain flared with unnatural heat. Kesha's wrist bulged oddly as she slashed the soul lash out again, carving divots from the street.
"Her hand!" Bok snarled.
Shale looked at him, eyes narrowed. Bok flung his arm to the side. A twist of the wrist and the weight of his concealed blade slid into his waiting hand. A moment later, the blade was flying through the air. It sank into Kesha's remaining eye with a wet, hollow sound. She staggered, blind.
"Now!"
he cried. Thankfully, the elf was quick on the uptake. Her blade chopped through Kesha's wrist. The soul lash and Kesha's hand clattered to the ground with a petulant rasp of iron links. As soon as the weapon hit the ground, Kesh toppled backwards with a sigh. Bok released a shaky breath. He approached the body carefully, but she seemed to have surrendered to the inevitable at last. He pried his blade free and wiped it clean on her ragged furs before tearing them from her body. He nudged the chain whip into the furs with his foot and wrapped it up. He could hear its links rasping in frustration.
"What an awful thing you are," he said,
as he tied the edges of the furs together.
"The Queen of Mysteries is welcome to you, and good riddance."
"Is she dead?"
the elf asked, as he lifted the bundle and slung it over his shoulder. She held a hand pressed to her gashed arm, but was otherwise unharmed.
"For the moment."
He looked up. The magpie's nest was completely aflame now. It had burned before, and he had no doubt it would be rebuilt, in time. He looked at Shale.
"You appear to be out of a job."
She shrugged.
"It was boring."
Bok hesitated. Then he smiled.
"Have you ever considered a career in the book trade?"
That was Auction of Blood by Josh Reynolds, read by John Banks. The Sands of Grief by Guy Haley, read by John Banks.
"I don't like it here, Master. Please let us go. Too much magic hurts my bones."
"Hush, Shattercap. They are nearly done, and then we can leave. Be patient."
The second speaker was Mesa, a proud elf prince in the bronze armour and green and grey clothing of the Wayfarer peoples. The first was a vicious spite, a small gangrel creature of ill intent. His appearance did nothing to disguise his nature. He was a clutch of bones and twiggy fingers, garbed in wizened green skin. From a small ape-like face, his button-black eyes peered at the world with fearful malice, in marked contrast to the calm benevolence radiated by his keeper. But though a captive, Shattercap was more or less content to live among the folds of the prince's cloak. Content because the elf offered a way out of wickedness, and Shattercap desired that in a half-grasped way. Less because the prince and the spite were at that time within the shop of Erasmus Throck and Durdek Grimson, providers of the finest alchemical instruments in Glimsforge, in the realm of Shyish, a place Shattercap feared greatly. Throck and Grimson were comical opposites. Grimson was a stout dwardin with a blue beard and bald head. Throck was a tall scrap of a man with a shock of white hair and clean-shaven chin. The dwardin rooted about behind the counter near the floor. The man was balanced upon rolling steps, searching cubbyholes high up by the ceiling. Grimson hauled out a leather-covered box and placed it on the glass countertop.
"This is it, elfling. The soul glass you wished for."
Throck tuttered from the top of the steps at his colleague.
"Come now, Durdek. Prince Mesa is high-born and worthy of respect."
Durdek's granitic face maintained its scowl.
"He's an elf, and I call it as I see it, Erasmus."
Throck shook his head and pulled the wheeled ladder along to the next stack of cubbyholes.
"Don't worry, your worthiness," said Grimson to Mesa. "I've outdone myself for you. Look at this."
With a delicacy his massive fingers seemed incapable of, Grimson took out a tiny hourglass. Its bulbs were no bigger than a child's clenched fists, decorated with delicate fretwork of silver and gold. Durdek flicked open a lid in the glass's top.
"Life sand goes in here. Seal it. Tip it over when it's near run out. Keep on with that to prolong the life within. Away you go. Very simple concept, but simple usage is no reason for drab work."
"We pride ourselves on the finest equipment," said Throck. "Durdek here makes the devices."
"And it's him as does the enchanting," said Durdek.
"It is a beautiful piece," said Mesa. He took the hourglass from Grimson and turned it over in his hands. Such fine workmanship. Grimson hooked his fingers into his belt, gave a loud sniff, and pulled himself up proudly.
We do what we can.
Aha! Here is the other item, said Throck.
He jumped from the ladder. From a soft velvet bag, he took out a complex compass. It, too, had a lid in the top, covering over a small compartment.
A soul seeker. This should lead you to the Realmstone deposit you seek.
Grimson took the glass and placed it carefully back into the box so Mesa could examine the compass. 8 nested circles of gold, each free-moving against the other, surrounded the central lidded well. On one side of the well was an indicator made in the shape of the hooked symbol of Shaiish. Mesa pushed it with his finger. It spun silently through many revolutions at the gentlest touch.
It floats on a bath of ghost silver, said Throck. Very good work.
Should be, said Shattercap, for the money you're being paid.
You get what you pay for, Grimson growled. Quality. We are Glimsforge's foremost makers of such devices.
We are expensive, I admit, but you will find none better, said Throck.
Indeed, said Mesa. I have no issue with the cost. Ignore my servant. He has yet to learn manners. He handed the compass back and produced a white leather pouch from his belt. 500 black diamond chips from the realm of Ulgu, as you required. Grimson took the bag from Mesa's hand and tugged at the drawstring, ready to count the contents. Throck patted his partner's burly arm.
That won't be necessary. I'm sure the prince is good to his word.
Throck was awed by the prince's breeding and couldn't help but give a short bow. Mesa returned the gesture with a graceful inclination of his head. Grimson looked at them both fiercely.
You best be careful out there, the Dwardin said. We sell maybe 8 or 9 of these a year, but the folks that buy them don't always come to the best end. Most go out into the sands of grief and vanish.
How do you know they work, then?
Said Shattercap, slinking around the back of Mesa's head from one shoulder to the other. Throck looked apologetic.
Their ghosts come back to tell us.
Ghost! Ghost! Master!
Squealed Shattercap.
Why did we come here?
I trust you have supernatural means of sustenance, said Throck amiably. I do not mean to pry into your business, but where you intend to go is no place for the living. There is no water, no food, no life of any kind. Only the dead and storms of wild magic. We can provide the necessary protections, amulets, enchanted victuals, all you would require, if you have none of your own.
Oh, no!
Shattercap shrieked again. Mesa ignored him. I have what I need. My kind have wandered in every place. This realm is no alien land to me. I shall return in person to inform you how well your goods performed. Mesa bowed and picked up his packages. My thanks, and good day to you, sirs. The door of the shop banged closed behind the prince. Shattercap cowered from the strange sights of Glimsforge. The sky was a bruised purple, forever brooding, its long night scattered with amethyst stars. Outside the walls were afterlives ruined by the war with chaos and haunted by broken souls. But the streets of the young city were full of life, bathed in the light of magical lanterns that held back the dark. Throck and Grimson's shop was located on Thaumaturgy Way, along with dozens of other purveyors of magical goods. Market stalls narrowed the street, leaving only a slender cobbled passage down the centre. Humans, elves, Dwardin, and all manner of other creatures thronged the market, and not only the living, but the shades of the dead also, for Glimsforge was situated in the afterlife of Lyria, where some vestiges of past glory still clung. The crowd moved slowly. People browsed goods, creating hard knots in the flow that eddied irritably around each other. Mesa could pass through a thicket of brambles without disturbing a twig, but his elven gifts were of no use in that place, and he was forced to shove through the crowd along with the rest.
"Market days! I hate market days!"
hissed Shattercap.
"So many people! Where is the forest quiet? Where is the mossy silence?"
"You will yearn for their fellowship where we are going, small evil," said Mesa. He slipped through a gaggle of ebon-skinned men of Gur, haggling over an imp imprisoned in a bottle, and reached the relative quiet of the main street. Free of the overhanging eaves of Thaumaturgy Way, more of the city was visible. Concentric rings of walls soared to touch the sky. The innermost held within their compass the Shimmer Gate, a blue slash of light high up in the dark sky. Shattercap and Mesa were in the second district, thus close to the Stormkeep, the College of Amethyst, and all the other wonders of the deepest ward. Mesa turned his back on the central spires. His destination lay outside the city. He returned to their lodgings in the fourth ward, and there arranged his equipment for the journey, while Shattercap fretted in the corner. The spite could have bolted at any time, and for that reason Mesa had kept the thing chained for the first part of their association. As the days passed, a bond had grown between them. Besides, Shattercap was too cowardly to flee, so Mesa had abandoned the fetters. Mesa packed his saddlebags with food, drink, and sustenance of a less mundane kind. He stowed his unstringed bow into its case on the outside of his quiver. The compass from Throck and Grimson he hung about his neck in its bag, and he stored the hourglass carefully in his packs. Lastly, he took from the table